from KALW News in San Francisco. This is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Richmond.
Outer Sunset.
Hey, I'm from Foster City.
I'm from Pleasant Chill.
Alameda.
I'm from Hercules.
Coming up, after 7 months, Oakland picks a new police chief.
We are in a new era of policing today, which requires us as police officers to think differently.
Then the rain worries neighbors at a creek that divides two cities.
I said, you guys need to enforce this. I said, if the Palo Alto side is higher than East Palo Alto side, that means that East Palo Alto will always flood and Palo Alto will never flood.
And a disability rights lawyer explains why bringing clients to the negotiating table can be more effective than bringing lawsuits.
Not only does it achieve great results, but it really makes a participant feel good about the process.
Stay tuned. Cross Currents is next. After nearly 7 months without a top cop, Oakland has a police chief again. Mayor Libby Schaff announced this morning that she's chosen Anne Kirkpatrick to lead the troubled department. Kirkpatrick is Oakland's first female police chief, and she's an outsider with a track record of leading reform efforts in Washington State and Chicago, Illinois. But bringing back trust won't be easy for a department that's been tainted by an underage sexual misconduct scandal and decades of controversy. KALW's justice reporter Holly J. McDeed explains what this pick means for Oakland's police and for the community.
The Oakland Police Department has had 8 different chiefs in the past decade. This time around, the search included months of community input meetings and hundreds of surveys, according to Oakland Mayor Libby Schaff.
And what Oaklanders had to say was very clear about what they wanted in their next police chief. Oaklanders wanted a leader with integrity, able to change culture.
The Oakland Police Officers Association issued a statement welcoming Kirkpatrick, saying they are glad the uncertainty surrounding the position is finally settled. The department has been operating without consistent leadership since last June, when former Oakland Police Chief Sean Wendt resigned, amidst the backdrop of a sexual misconduct scandal involving dozens of Bay Area police officers and an underage sex trafficking victim. In the following 2 weeks, 2 more Oakland Police Chiefs also resigned. Now Kirkpatrick, with nearly 30 years of experience in law enforcement, says she plans to break the cycle of short-term leaders.
Now, I plan to be so good that you want me, okay? But the normal tenure in the country right now to be a police chief is between 2.5 and 3 years. In every city where I have been brought in as a chief of police, and I've been in 3 as a chief of police, I lasted 5 years. In one city, I lasted 5.5.
Kirkpatrick has been police chief of 3 different cities in Washington State, most recently Spokane. Now she leaves her job at the Chicago Police Department. There, she was hired last summer to lead reform efforts arising from the fatal police shooting of Laquan McDonald, a black teenager shot 16 times by a white police officer. In that role, Kirkpatrick helped push for a policy limiting the department's use of deadly force.
Reform is where we have policies and procedures and we direct behavior. Reform. I am more interested in transformation. We are in a new era of policing today, which requires us as police officers to think differently without losing the fundamental basics of what it is to be a police officer.
Kirkpatrick arrives as OPD enters its 13th year under a federal oversight monitoring program, and months after voters overwhelmingly passed a measure to create a civilian-led commission to investigate officer misconduct. She plans to officially start working in February. Until then, the city administrator, Sabrina Landreth, will remain in charge of the police department, as she has been since June. For Cross Currents, I'm Holly J. McDeed.
We're setting up a conversation with Oakland Mayor Libby Schaff to talk about the state of the city. What questions do you have for her? Let us know at 415-264-7106. Share your questions for Oakland Mayor Libby Schaff at 415-264-7106. This week promises lots of rain for the whole Bay Area, But too much of a good thing can sometimes turn bad. Erosion, mudslides, and flooding are a danger. In 1998, El Niño storms caused over $500 million of damage statewide. 17 people died, and 35 counties were declared federal disaster areas. East Palo Alto was hit especially hard. The San Francisquito Creek flooded after a week of heavy rain and damaged 1,700 homes. This winter, residents are worried the same thing could happen again. KALW's Angela Johnston has the story.
Spencina Sims remembers the 98 flood like it was yesterday.
It was a lot of rain.
Her backyard borders the San Francisquito Creek in East Palo Alto. She and her husband Curtis have lived in this house for 50 years. Curtis says he was watching television when he got a call from his neighbor asking if they were going to evacuate. He was surprised.
Until I went to the patio and water was almost, you know, like I said, coming through the bottom of the patio door. So that's when we left.
As they scrambled to leave, firemen and police officers began driving around in cars and boats, speaking through megaphones, urging people to evacuate.
And we was out of our house for 3 months.
They moved in with a relative a few blocks away. They didn't have flood insurance, so they had to pay most of the repair bills themselves, thousands of dollars, before they could move back home. Then, in 2012, the creek overflowed again. This time, it only flooded their garage.
And we had water, I mean, up to almost our knees when we got in the car to leave here.
Curtis takes me out into the backyard to show me signs of the previous floods. He points to a fence they built after the 1998 flood. The creek is right on the other side. He unlocks the gate and we walk out onto the creek's levee. It's basically just a raised pile of gravel and dirt. The bottom foot of the fence is coated with a fine layer of dry mud. He says it's left over from 2012.
See that mud?
Yeah.
That'll tell you how high the water come up on the fence. And over there, the most of the water, it come over there, but it spread it across this whole area.
Curtis hopes that if the creek overflows this year, it'll be different. That his neighborhood will be protected by something called a sandbag burrito. Yes, a sandbag burrito.
Well, basically, it's taking sand, either in sandbags or sand-free sand, and wrapping it in concrete.
That's Len Matterman. He's the executive director of the San Francisquito Creek Joint Powers Authority. The sandbag burritos are actually a well-known piece of infrastructure in the engineering world. And on the outside, they don't look much like actual burritos, just long cement mounds. It's the wrapping process that gives them their names. The sand is like the rice and beans. They get wrapped tightly in a tarp, the tortilla. And then that gets wrapped again in cement, the foil. Their purpose?
To raise the elevation of the levee to slightly more than match what's on the Palo Alto side.
The San Francisquito Creek runs through the towns of Palo Alto, East Palo Alto, and Menlo Park. It also divides two counties. After the 1998 flood, they all got together to try to restore the creek, to make sure the same thing didn't happen again. The idea, Matterman said, was to transform the creek into something that people could be proud of, not afraid of. But that's easier said than done.
This creek is the county line. It's also the dividing line between cities. It's very difficult to work on a creek that is a county line and a city line because you have different players that have different interests, and there's no way to fix half of it.
The sandbag burritos were constructed early last year in preparation for El Niño. They're only temporary, though. They'll last about 4 or 5 years before they start to rot and disintegrate from within. The real fix has just started, completely rebuilding the levee, making it wider, higher, and stronger to prevent flooding in even the worst of storms.
This whole community here is below sea level. And if water overtops, and you think about it, it basically just starts filling up behind the levee. And so it doesn't have a way to drain to the bay. It's kind of like a bathtub, right? It just starts filling up. And that's what really worries us.
It's especially worrisome because one side of the creek is more vulnerable than the other. Matterman and I are standing on the bank of the creek in East Palo Alto. And just feet away, right in front of us, is the city of Palo Alto, a completely different city with a different government, a university, an airport, the 101 freeway. and Palo Alto is not below sea level. It's also one of the wealthiest cities in the Bay Area. East Palo Alto is one of the poorest. And most of the 5,000 or so homes in the creek's floodplain are in East Palo Alto.
There's definitely property damage and life safety issues in Palo Alto. But in terms of life safety, this is the really critical area right here.
Where we're standing, where Spencina and Curtis Sims live. And if the Palo Alto side of the creek is built even just an inch higher, East Palo Alto will always flood. That's why it was important to build the sandbag burritos the exact same height on both sides. Last year's El Nino was predicted to be stronger than the one in 1998, the one that displaced Spencina and Curtis Sims and so many others from their homes. But it didn't live up to the hype.
This will protect people from what we saw 3 years ago, but not what we saw 17 years ago.
Only a new, rebuilt levee will prevent that type of flooding. The permanent fix was supposed to be finished last year, but because of the mix of cities, counties, and organizations involved, construction only started this past June. But at least both sides of the creek are talking.
It's extremely difficult, but it's also very refreshing to see them all work together.
Dennis Parker lives just down the street from the Sims in East Palo Alto. He moved here in 1999, the year after the last big flood. And he knows that the sandbag burritos won't work as well as the permanent fix. His house doesn't back up along the creek, but he's still preparing his family and his neighborhood for a major flood.
Some people make their own emergency kits, but you can also buy them.
He became a leader of his community emergency response team. He learned how to operate a ham radio and keeps emergency kits in his two cars and another one in his garage.
It's got some drinking water, it's got a flashlight, it's got a first aid kit.
Parker says he's happy there's been some creek restoration work this year, and he thinks the sandbag burritos are a good sign. He's getting ready for the worst, but it's been difficult to convince his neighbors to do the same.
But, you know, people are just apathetic in general. They really don't want to think about. Well, some of it is apathy and some of it is denial. Oh, it's not really going to rain that hard.
At an El Nino prep meeting last year, only a dozen or so residents came out. This upsets Parker. He says it might be because of a language or cultural barrier. According to the last census, East Palo Alto is over 60% Latino. Or maybe, he says, it's because East Palo Alto doesn't have its own local paper. Whatever the cause, it makes him worried. Worried about how people are going to know something is wrong.
It's like, how do you really know when it's time to get out of here?
A new flood warning app created by Len Matterman and the Joint Powers Authority can help. But you need internet or cell phone access to use it. I asked Spencina and Curtis Sims if they've signed up. They don't use the internet, they told me. They'll get live updates from friends and family.
You ain't got to worry about it, so we be aware. We'll know it when it happens.
The Joint Powers Authority has paused construction of the levee for the winter. They hope to resume in the spring. Until then, people like the Sims are relying on their neighbors and the sandbag burritos. In East Palo Alto, I'm Angela Johnston for Cross Currents.
Angela is KALW's energy and environment reporter. Tell her what stories you'd like us to cover. You can email her at environment@kalw.org. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Ben Trefney, in for Hana Baba. Disability rights lawyer Lainey Feingold is known for negotiating landmark accessibility agreements. She pioneered a dispute resolution method called structured negotiations. Instead of suing companies to be more accessible to the disabled, she talks with them, builds relationships, and brings her disabled clients to the negotiating table. She's now written a book about her successful strategies. It's called Structured Negotiation, A Winning Alternative to Lawsuits. Lainey Feingold talked with KALW's Hana Baba about how it works, starting with the first case she took on, talking ATMs at banks.
When I think about my work, I think about the first thing we started with, which was ATMs that talk for blind people. And in the mid-90s, there were none anywhere in the world. And the blind community came to me and to my colleagues and said, you know, we have the Americans with Disabilities Act. We really should be able to use an ATM privately, mm-hmm. like anybody else does. And instead of suing, we wrote letters to Bank of America, Wells Fargo, and Citibank. And much to our surprise, all those banks said, yeah, we will work with you on developing talking ATMs. And that's what happened. And my earliest memories of doing this kind of work is just watching how these bankers, you know, sort of traditional bankers who originally felt, oh, we could put Braille on our machines, that'll be enough.
Right.
They would meet blind people, they would see that they could not use the ATM, and it would be like a light bulb going off.
Hmm.
And that really cemented the idea that forming relationships is a really key part of resolving legal problems.
Because before that, was it primarily about the lawsuit? That was the way that things got done?
That's the way I had always done things. And when I represented labor unions, we did arbitration. But in both of those systems, you have a third party making the decision.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're giving up some amount of control. And it's very procedural basis, rules. It's when can you talk to people? How do you talk to them? What roles, especially in disability rights, disabled people are often the people who know best what they need.
Mm-hmm.
When you stick yourself into a lawsuit, a plaintiff doesn't always have a voice in the solution.
And what else is lost when people choose lawsuit versus no lawsuit? What is gained and what's lost?
That's a very good question. And in the book, I actually have a checklist for lawyers and clients and advocates to go over at the beginning to mm-hmm. figure out what really is the best strategy mm-hmm. to solve the legal problem that they have in front of them. And the biggest thing I think that's lost when you do a lawsuit is the control, because you're having a third party decide. On the other hand, sometimes you reach an impasse and you need a third party. And it's a lot more expensive to do things in litigation.
So you tried it. It seems like it worked, that these big banks were receptive to just talking to them, basically, and letters, which seems really interesting that that would work. Why do you think they were receptive to that? In our minds, they are these big banks and corporations. And, you know, what was it that got them?
I think there's many answers to that. I think when approached in a collaborative way, without rules to say no, when you file a lawsuit, there's a whole bunch of ways you can say no to that lawsuit. When you send a letter and we explain what the legal claim is, and it's serious, it's not like it's less serious, but it's a way of saying, here's another path to solve these problems. And not that they embraced us with open arms,
mm-hmm.
but you don't need to be embraced with open arms. You just need a little sliver where the company or the government agency is saying, wait, that might make sense. You know, why don't we see if we can work on this together? It'll save us money. They lose control, too, if mm-hmm. they go to a court.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's the control, the money. And I also think structured negotiation in the issues I work on give these big companies an opportunity to do the right thing.
At what point did you feel, you know, structured negotiations will work in different types of cases against different types of entities? At what point did you realize that I have a thing and it's working?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think we named it structured negotiation after we were successful with those first three banks. So in the field of talking ATMs, which we then went on to do with banks across the country, and also with accessible websites, because as we were working with the banks towards the end of the ATM development, all of a sudden everyone was starting to do their banking online. And if websites aren't coded properly on the back end, blind people cannot use them. So we went to Bank of America and we said, well, I know we haven't talked about this in 4 years, but we have a new issue. And mm-hmm. if we had been in a lawsuit, we would have had to tell a judge about it. The bank could have said, you're way too late on this. You never mentioned it. But instead, we had the relationship. And so when we told them we have to work on online banking, they did. And we got Bank of America to do the first agreement in the country in 2000 on making sure that online banking could work for disabled people.
And what does that tell the disabled community when these big corporations are actually receptive to your work? What message is that?
Well, the message was, whoa, this is a effective strategy.
Mm-hmm.
One thing I say throughout the book, I'm not here to say it's the only strategy,
right,
but it's been a really effective strategy.
So do you see then structured negotiation working in other fields other than disability?
I think it will. And I'm hoping my readers are going to answer that question. I wrote the book as a way to give the method over to people in all fields, and not just lawyers. It's not just written for lawyers. It's also for advocates who can go to their lawyers and say, you know, we think this might be a good strategy for our legal claims. So the book is really a roadmap through the process, how to write the kind of letter that will invite people to participate, how to agree on ground rules, how to have a meeting when there's no court rules telling you when, where, and how. Those sorts of things. So I am hopeful and I'm actually confident that the process will be useful in a whole variety of different kinds of situations. That not only does it achieve great results, but it really makes the participants feel good about the process. We work with a lot of big pharmacy companies on talking prescription labels, and I brought a sample if you want to.
Talking prescription labels?
Yeah, yeah.
I want to see a talking prescription label.
You.
Can I see?
Yeah, yeah, I want to show you.
So what is this?
Okay, so I've just given you like a, looks like a piece of plastic, maybe a CD player size.
Mm-hmm.
And the company called Envision America makes those available to blind people for free. Then the next thing to show you is a standard looking prescription bottle.
Right.
And you couldn't tell, but at the very bottom, there's a RFID chip. Radio frequency ID chip.
Mm-hmm.
And now we're going to put the bottle on the reader and see what happens.
Okay.
Patient. John Smith. Medication. Amoxicillin, 250 milligram tablets. Instructions. Take one tablet 3 times daily with meals.
That's fascinating. And so that came out of a structured negotiation settlement.
Yes, we've actually done structured negotiation about talking prescription labels with several major pharmacies. And this is another example where the blind community had an opportunity to work with the pharmacists and say, we really need to have information on the labels. When you think about it, if you give a print label to a blind person, it's as if you give a sighted person medication with no label at all. So this has been one of the success stories of structured negotiation because the law does not specifically require this particular product, but in structured negotiation, the parties can work together on solution, and this is the solution we've worked out in several cases.
That's Lainey Feingold, a disability rights lawyer and author of Structured Negotiation, a winning alternative to lawsuits. She spoke with KALW's Hanna Baba. To find out more about her work, head to our website, kalw.org. That's our show today. The team includes Leela Day, Nina Gensler-Debs, Jürgen Klemm, Olivia Henry, Angela Johnston, Jeremy Ju, Ted Muldoon, Lisa Morehouse, James Rollins, Judy Silber, Carrie Spivak, Stephen Short, and Andrew Stalzer. The show was engineered by Chris Hoff. The line producer was Hannah Kingsley Ma. Our managing editor is Jen Cheehan. Our managing producer is Julie Kane. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. The voice you're hearing now belongs to LaVey Smith. She's kicking off the new year with an evening of songs associated with jazz great Billie Holiday. LaVey Smith and an all-star band appear Saturday at the Red Poppy Art House in San Francisco. Music starts at 7:30 p.m. For Cross Currents, I'm Ben Trefney. He said, Mom, you sure look fine. I said, baby.
time. I don't need a house, a Cadillac car, no Lord, diamond rings. I don't need champagne or caviar. But baby, let me tell you, there's just one thing. I need a big fine daddy. I need a big